in Sloane's direction that morning. Sloane felt like something in the center of her had hardened into a tight knot of muscle. Esther hadn't given her much acknowledgement either. It was as if Sloane were someone Esther recognized, but she couldn't remember from where. But dealing with situations like these, Sloane knew, was just a matter of knowing the right procedures. She had learned how to disappear after Cameron died, and her mother burrowed into her bed and never came out again. You dealt with it the same way you dealt with the cold when you didn't have the right jacket. You let the chill pass through you, digging deep into your bones, until you could no longer feel it. The Hall of Summons was huge and empty. The walls, concentric circles of stone, curved up to a covered oculus at the highest point of its domed ceiling. Sunlight streamed through the stained glass, casting bright spots of blue and green on a far wall where there was a rusted door. Directly beneath the oculus, set into the floor, there was a metal plate. A little like a drain cover, but larger, maybe 6 feet in diameter. There were decorative flourishes in the plate, curlicues twisting together like vines. Sloane thought back to what Nero had said about there being a powerful siphon fortis in Chicago. This had to be it. The room felt strange, like the air was too close. When they walked in, Aelia was using her siphon and a whistle to guide a large stone table to the center of the room. Nero was at her shoulder, showing her a page from a book that barely fit in the cradle of his arm, it was so large. "Ah," Aelia said when she set the table down. "Thank you, Cyrielle. Good morning to the rest of you. I can't stay long, but I stopped by to make sure that your accommodations were satisfactory." "Well," Sloane said, "it's hard to be satisfied with what is essentially a prison cell, but sure, great pillows." Esther gave her a sideways look, familiar. Then she seemed to realize she wasn't supposed to do that and angled her body away so Sloane couldn't see her face. Sloane let that pass through her. Soon, she wouldn't even feel it. Aelia pursed her lips. "Well, as you may have observed, it is essential that you be able to do small workings with a siphon in order to get by in this building, let alone to pursue your mission. Therefore, Nero will be teaching you how to do some things with the siphons before we move forward with your mission. Nero will be..."
"Actually," Matt said, "before we start, I have a request."
Aelia's mouth puckered like she had just tasted something sour. "Yes?"
"I want to know more about this connection between our universes," Matt said.
Sloane had told Esther and Matt about the article she found in the library, and they agreed that it was enough to tentatively trust what Nero and Aelia had claimed, but not enough for them to risk their lives.
"Everything you know, basically."
"Also," Esther added, "no offense, but if there isn't a connection, then it'll feel like you're lying to us to get us to risk our asses for people and a place we don't even know. And I, personally, have done enough risking of my ass for one lifetime." "I'm not sure how to demonstrate what we know about the connection," Aelia said. "At least not without all of you attaining a somewhat advanced understanding of magic."
"Well," Matt said with a smile, "I suggest you figure something out."
Aelia shot a look at Nero. He cleared his throat. "I will commit myself to it," Nero said. "In the meantime, perhaps you would still be amenable to learning a few siphon skills so that you can move more freely through the building."
"How about outside this building?" Sloane said. "Or does our leash not extend that far?"
Aelia was not provoked. "At this time, we don't think it would be safe for you to leave the building," she said. "You don't know anything about our world, and you don't know how to use siphons."
"But after we learn more," Matt said, "surely your policy will change."
Sloane covered her mouth to hide a grin. Aelia reminded her of a wind-up toy. Each demand they made twisted her up a little more. "We will evaluate it as the situation develops," Aelia replied. "I will leave you in Nero's and Cyrielle's capable hands." Aelia rearranged the fabric of her stiff cowl,
smiled with pursed lips, and walked out of the Hall of Summons, her shoes snapping all the way down the hall. As the sound faded away, Cyrielle approached the box that was on the stone table and started laying out its contents. A line of handheld devices that resembled recorders, the kind that Sloane had seen reporters use during interviews. Cyrielle placed one next to each siphon and switched each one on. A small screen lit up green at the top of the device, right below what appeared to be a microphone. "Well, shall we begin?" Nero said, bringing his hands together in front of him. "The purpose of today's lesson will be to master something very simple, something we teach children on Genetrix. We call it a magical breath. But in order to do that, you need to know the basics of what makes a working, which is what we call any act of magic, no matter how small." "Like a spell?" Esther said. "No incantations are involved, so I think that was deemed inaccurate," Nero said. "What is involved is sound. If magical energy is like water, then certain frequencies are like channels in stone that provide pathways for particular workings. And we help you to find the right frequencies with one of these." He picked up one of the devices from the table. "It's formally known in the magical community as a praecontograph, but it's just a modified oscilloscope. It measures frequencies with the attached microphone. A sophisticated praecontograph can be set to tell you what category of working your frequency falls in."
"Does that mean men and women do different kinds of workings, usually?" Matt said. "Because men's voices are usually lower."
"Yes. When the sound comes from the voice," Nero said, smiling, "there are an array of small instruments that can be used to produce a wide range of frequencies. And though some people do make their workings quite musical, even someone with a horrible ear for music, or someone who can't hear at all, can still make sound at the correct frequency."
"That's a relief," Esther said, "because I've been told that when I sing, I sound like a drowning cat."
"The range of workings possible with the human voice are quite limited anyway," Nero said. "But the magical breath is one of them, which makes it ideal for children. Unfortunately, for male adults," here he looked at Matt, "the frequency is somewhat high, 170 megahertz. I have a whistle if you can't quite manage it."
"My falsetto isn't bad," Matt said.
"Excellent. Well, first, everyone take an oscilloscope, and we'll all try to find the right frequency." Sloane went up to the table with the others to pick up one of the devices. While she was there, she looked over the siphons. They were simple, made of black, grainy metal, with a plate for the back of the hand and one for the palm, like a glove without fingertips. A standard-issue siphon, Sloane guessed, whereas Nero's and Cyrielle's were for the wealthy. A logo was stamped on the back. A beast with a bird's head, a man's torso, and a serpent's tail instead of legs. The tail was curled around a large A. "Abraxas," Nero said when he saw her staring at it. "They make the highest quality siphons." Sloane stepped back, an oscilloscope in hand, into the line with the others. Cyrielle then sang a note. Her voice was unwavering. Not especially beautiful, but the sound was consistent, easy to mimic. Nero gestured for them to repeat the noise. Sloane's cheeks heated up. She had never sung in front of people. She didn't even sing in the shower. She wasn't tone deaf. She just didn't do it. She held the oscilloscope's microphone up close to her mouth and hummed. A wavy line appeared on the device's screen, as well as the number 165. It took a few tries to hit 170 megahertz on the nose, but once she found the pitch, she was able to do it again without too much difficulty. Next to her, Esther was rolling her eyes at the oscilloscope, her lips pursed as she whistled.
Matt, however, was singing "Ah," like he was doing a vocal warm-up. Sloan wondered if he would have been in choir if he had been allowed to live a normal life. Her chest felt tight at the thought.
"Good," Nero said. "Now, siphons. Put them on your dominant hands, but don't make any noise just yet."
The siphon was cold against her skin and loose. Cyriel saw her fussing with it and stepped over to tease a small wire from the space between the plates. When she pulled it tight, the plates drew together around Sloane's hand, and she wrapped it around a small hook to keep it secure. Sloane flexed her fingers. The siphon was clunkier than the one Nero wore, but it wasn't uncomfortable, and the metal warmed the longer she wore it, like a wristwatch. "You may have noticed Aelia or me making a small gesture when we do a working," Nero said. "That doesn't actually have any impact on the working itself. It's more of a way of getting your mind to realize that you are trying to do something. So gesture or don't, it doesn't matter. Whatever helps you to focus your intentions. What we call a magical breath is just a small puff of air emitted magically by the user. When I tell you to, you will make your sound at the correct frequency, and you will try to have that tricky nebulous thing we refer to in magical study as intent." He glanced at Sloane. That was the word he had used the day before to explain why the siphon on its own wasn't dangerous. Nailing down exactly what constitutes intent is the subject of the majority of magical theory, Nero said. But there is a reason it's easier to teach someone magic if they've been learning since they were a child. Children don't need explanations or details in the way that adults do. They can just want something and do it. So I can't tell you exactly how to have the right intent. You just have to figure it out. The less thinking involved, the better at this stage.
"This should be easy for Esther, then," Matt said.
"Kindly shut the hell up," Esther replied. She held up her hand in the siphon and whistled while flicking her hand in a dismissive gesture. Esther's hair fluttered, and she stepped back, eyes wide. A moment later, a grin crept over her face, revealing a small splotch of lipstick on her teeth. "I did it," she said in something like a shriek. The grin took years away from her face, so Sloane felt like she was looking at the Esther who had not been through the war, who had not fought the Dark One, who had not been caring for her sick mother. Matt gave Esther a high five, and Sloane, not sure her congratulations would be welcome, opted for a smile. "Yes, well done," Nero said. "Now the rest of you." Sloane stared at her hand, sheathed in its siphon. "Don't think," she thought. She hummed, and the oscilloscope read 175 megahertz. Another hum got her closer to her target. "Don't think. Do a gesture that feels natural." She wasn't sure that any gesture could feel natural with a metal glove on her hand. She tried flicking her first two fingers. That seemed simple enough. Nothing happened. Across the room, Matt was singing his "Ah," and waving his hand through the air like he was conducting an orchestra. She would have laughed if things weren't so bad between them. Esther's whistling was accompanied by a finger waggle, and she was holding the oscilloscope up to her face to read her pitch. "Don't think," she scolded herself, and she hummed again. "Intent," she reminded herself. Well, maybe that was the problem. She didn't intend anything at all. She had no idea why a person would want to magically conjure a puff of air when you could just as easily make one with your mouth. She closed her eyes and instead tried to think of how it had felt when she had faced the Aeris prototype in the dome with the needle halves in hand. The great yawn inside her, and then the gnaw of hunger, as essential to her body as the need for air or the lure of sleep. Sloane focused on that gnawing, not even knowing what she hungered for, with breakfast still sitting in her belly. The desire was shapeless still, but she felt it.
She always felt it. She held up her hand and hummed. And then she felt it, at last. The first tingle of magic she had detected on Genetrix. A moment later, it was more than a tingle. It was as if she had opened a door, a crack, to see who was knocking and found an inferno waiting at her doorstep. Burning consumed her body, stinging her eyes, scorching her throat. She screamed and thrashed against it, but the burning kept coming. She couldn't see. Her hair had blown across her eyes, and her clothes had pulled away from her. Air swirled around her like a skein of silk at first, and then like tight threads, binding her, lifting her. A sharp crack sounded. The window that covered the oculus had broken, and glass was spilling down like a waterfall in the center of the room. Someone shouted slow. Something hit her in the head, and the fire went out. Sloane fell back and landed hard on the tile. Her head slammed into the ground, making her wince. Esther, who was also on the floor, crawled over to her hair clinging to her painted lips. Light was streaming into the room from above. "You all right?" Esther said, pushing her hand under Sloane's head to feel her scalp. "Shit, Sloane. You don't do anything halfway, do you?" "Essie," she said. "Slo's gonna vom." At least she had enough presence of mind to turn her head away from Esther before she did.
Throat Siphons Are Here, But at a Cost. By Corey Jones. Magitech Mag, number 240. Ever since Abraxas, then operating under the name of its former parent company, IBM, first dipped a toe into siphon manufacture in the United States in the 1970s, it has dominated the tech sphere in North America. This latest release, the first consumer-focused throat siphon, is no exception, yet its prohibitive cost of more than $5,000 per unit has many complaining about the company's priorities. They have left cost-cutting efforts to smaller, inferior manufacturers and instead focused solely on innovation. The narrowness of vision seems to have paid off. Abraxas's presence in the market has never been greater. Researchers at the Cordis Center have estimated that only 20% of the population possess the magical faculties necessary to make use of a throat siphon, so the development of the device has been controversial since its inception. It seemed unlikely that manufacturing them would be profitable for any company, large or small. But Abraxas's current CEO and founder, Valens Walker, insisted, "We don't need to sell every siphon we produce to every customer," he said in an interview with the New York Times last winter. "We just need to sell the best ones available." So far, they do. Magitech Mag's reviews of Abraxas products have yielded A's across the board, whereas the closest Abraxas competitor, Trench, averages a B-, with its startlingly cheap wrist siphon as its standout product. So what about Abraxas's throat siphon? Well, it came to me in a sleek gold box, so clearly Abraxas is playing up the exclusivity angle. The object itself is far from inconspicuous. It's a seamless metal plate, copper in color, that's engraved across the front with one of three patterns: floral brocade, herringbone, or damask. It's 2 inches high, so there's no way to hide it behind a collar. This thing is meant to be displayed, and I'm sure fashion designers will accommodate with neck-revealing clothing, as they did with shortened sleeves when wrist siphons were first released. The look is a little bit much for me, to be honest, but it's lightweight and adjustable, so I hardly noticed it while I was wearing it. As to its performance, though, well, if you've ever attempted a throat working before, you know why those who can will, almost exclusively, use this type of magic. A throat siphon is particularly attuned to those who hum or sing their workings, being so close to the vocal cords, it picks up the vibrations from the skin, which means workings can be done quietly and discreetly, It doesn't broadcast one's intent with an ostentatious whistle, as other siphons do. And the range of what is possible with a throat siphon is, obviously, expanded. All the basic workings are effortless: opening doors, lighting candles, moving objects. And I finally performed some complex ones without being in a classroom. I set a timer on a working that kept my pencil spinning, with the help of an oscilloscope, in the privacy of my apartment. That's one of the downsides: the necessity of the oscilloscope. Throat siphons are more sensitive to minor deviations in pitch, so you have to be precise. And unless you have perfect pitch, you're going to need extra equipment. If you want to set an indefinite clock, you'll still need to find an assembly to support your efforts. But the force of your workings should mean the assemblies can be smaller and take less energy. If you're doing a sequential working, you don't have to break between pitch changes, as you would with a wrist siphon, but you have to be decisive about your shifts, or you'll end up with unexpected outcomes. As with any new siphon, the government's going to be keeping a close eye on new users, so don't try to raise your own undead army just yet. That's a joke, guys. One resurrectionist is plenty, don't you think? But this tech could very well change magic forever. Abraxas's Throat Siphon 1.0 will be available on Friday, February 3.
Chapter 20. Sloan fell asleep almost immediately after the incident in the Hall of Summons. And when she woke up, it was the following morning. Matt and Cyrielle had helped her back to her room. She had counted their footsteps and tried not to think of the destruction she had left behind. All the siphons and oscilloscopes scattered wide. Cold air rushing into the bared oculus. Glass strewn across the floor in blue, green, and red. Nero's cape, blown free of its clasps, flapping on the floor. Cyrielle's braided updo ripped from its pins. They had sat her down on the mattress, and when Matt left to go get her a glass of water, she looked up at Cyrielle and said, "What does it mean that I did that?" "I don't know," Cyrielle replied. "But no one was hurt. You'll try again another time, and we'll take precautions." "There won't be another time," Sloane said, and she fell asleep without taking her feet off the floor. She didn't know what time it was now. She woke like someone who had been blackout drunk the night before, putting herself together in pieces. She sat up, swiped her fingers under her eyes, combed them through her hair, straightened her clothes. Matt had set a glass of water on her low white bedside table, and she drank it in a single gulp, searching the room for her shoes. Someone had taken them off for her and put them next to the door. Sloane put them on, pulled the laces tight, and checked the hallway for any sign of the others. Their doors were closed, their lights off. They were still asleep. No one would notice if she stepped out for a while. Aelia didn't want them to leave the building, so, naturally, that was exactly what Sloane had decided to do. Sloane knew Nero had some way of checking up on them, but she didn't know what it was. She couldn't summon the elevator regardless, so she decided to take her chances again with the stairwell. If stealth couldn't be her ally, then she would have to opt for speed. Sloane reached the end of the hallway where she could see the stairwell door and ran. She pushed through the door and took the stairs three at a time, then four as she got her bearings. She hadn't gone for a run in a while, so the pounding of her heart and the ache of her limbs were a welcome distraction from everything that had happened. She was eager for cold, fresh air and the feeling of pavement under her boot soles. When she reached the ground floor, she noted the emergency exit, but the alarm will sound sign put her off trying it. She went through another door to the lobby instead. She had passed through it a few times with the others. It was a wide open space that felt, with all its ornate decoration, Baroque, Sloane thought, and its flying buttresses, Gothic. and its hints of gilded geometry, art deco, like the sanctuary of a church. The heavy wooden doors leading outside only enhanced that feeling. Cameron would have approved, she thought. She walked straight toward the doors, her path, for the moment, clear of obstacles. Sloane. A man she didn't recognize stepped in front of her. Military, she decided, judging by his impeccable posture, ample musculature, and right, the uniform. Navy blue pants, casual, tucked into his boots. Long-sleeved gray shirt, sleeves pushed up to his elbows. The same symbol that the others by the riverwalk had pinned to their chests was stitched on the right side of his chest. She considered sprinting for the doors, but she decided the time wasn't right for such an act of desperation. Not yet, anyway. So she just made a show of not being intimidated. "Listen," she said. "The more determined you are to keep me here, the more determined I'm going to be to leave. So why don't we skip the whole ramp up in tensions?" "Okay," the man said. "What if I told you that my job is not to stop you from leaving, but to accompany you to ensure that you don't get into any trouble?" Sloane looked out the windows to the street beyond them, the view obscured by the thick ripple in each pane of glass. She could almost taste the air coming off the water of Lake Michigan. "I should add," the man said, "that if you don't agree to let me do my job, there will be a lot of fuss and tedious arguing." "All right," she said. "Fine." "My name is Kyros," he said, offering his hand for her to shake. Firm grip, she thought. Not surprising. "I'm a captain in the new army of Flickering. Not that that will mean much to you." He wore a siphon on his wrist, simpler than the ones she had observed thus far. Just polished metal plates covering the back of his hand and palm, but leaving his fingers free. The logo she had seen on the siphon she had used the day before, the creature with the head of a bird, torso of a man, and tail of a snake, was etched into one of the plates. "Magic Army," she said. "Right. What makes it new?" "The previous army was massacred by the Resurrectionist," he replied. "Where would you like to go?" "Guess we're just going to breeze past the massacre then," she thought. "To the lake," she said. The lakefront had always been a kind of anchor for her. If she ever lost her way, all she had to do was find it, and she would know which way was east. She could name the streets that ran parallel to it: Lakeshore, Columbus, Michigan, Wabash, State, Dearborn, Clark, LaSalle, all the way to the river. Going there, to the water, might help her find something steady inside her, even in Genetrix. Kyros flicked his index finger at the double doors, and they opened. His control, she noted, was impressive. The doors opened just enough for both of them, rather than flying apart as they had done for Aelia. But regardless, it seemed like a frivolous use of magic. "For future reference," she said as she passed through them, "I can open my own doors." "My apologies," Kyros said. "It's just a reflex." "A world of magic at your fingertips," she thought, "and you're using it to open a door." Outside, they fell into step right away with the rest of the population on the sidewalk. Sloane noted their shoes. They favored pointed toes with hard bottoms that made sharp sounds, almost like tap shoes. And the heavy drape of fabric around their necks and shoulders, which left their throats bare to display throat siphons. The wide sleeves that stopped in the middle of their forearms to show off wrist siphons. The intricately braided hair that revealed bejeweled ear siphons, the most ornate kind by Sloane's observation. Across the street was the comforting sight of the Daily Center, a dark brown block of a building that had, evidently, made it through the splitting of their two universes. But across the street, where at home there had been a tall modern structure with pale blue windows, there was a cluster of spires that reminded her of the church in Barcelona, La Sagrada Familia, made of dense and ornate stone. The thought brought a familiar pang. Cameron had once brought home a book on architecture from the library, and he must have forgotten to return it, because Sloane had found it in his bedroom after he died. The pages with his favorite buildings dog-eared. La Sagrada Familia had been one of them. "So this resurrectionist," she said. "If I see him, and I assume I'll know him when I see him, what should I do?" "What you should do is learn basic defensive maneuvers with your siphon," Kyros said. "There is a shield that is simple to learn that seems to buy people time when they face him. It keeps him from performing his favorite working." "And what's that?" "He collapses lungs," Kyros said, in the same frank way he had told her about the army massacre. "It is difficult to get them to reinflate before a person suffocates, and they are unable to do it themselves since they can't make noise." Sloane suppressed a shudder. "Okay," she said. "So, shield." "Here," he said. "I'll show you." He put a hand on her elbow and steered her into an alley clogged with cardboard boxes and sacks of trash. She would have protested if she hadn't been so eager to see the shield. Kyros held his hand out from his shoulder, palm facing Sloane, and whistled between his teeth at a pitch so high she clapped her hands over her ears. Sloane wondered how such a sound was possible until she saw something glint in Kyros's mouth. A false tooth? A piercing? She couldn't tell. Whatever it was, at its whistle, the air appeared thicker, the way it did when gas leaked from a stove. Sloane watched it ripple in front of Kyros with each exhale. She reached for it, almost unconsciously, the child in her always eager to discover by touch. It felt viscous, silky, like still water. "It won't stop him," Kyros said, his voice muffled by the barrier between them. "But it will delay him." "Too bad I'm such shit with siphons," she said. "You should endeavor not to be such shit," Kyros said, a determined set to his jaw. "Or you put yourself and everyone around you in danger, particularly if you insist on leaving the safety of the courtesender unaccompanied." "Point taken." She got the feeling Kyros didn't like her very much. Kyros dismissed the shield with a grave look, and they kept walking. They passed some businesses that looked familiar: bakeries, sandwich shops, pizza places. It wasn't until she walked past a coffee shop with a blue awning that she realized she was looking for a Starbucks and wasn't finding one. This place was called Jack's Magic Beans, and the logo was, of course, the white outline of a beanstalk disappearing into a cloud. At the intersection of Randolph and State, she realized the walk signal was not the glowing white man she was used to, but rather a piece of metal that flipped over every time the signals changed, displaying a series of layered circles. The stop image was a solitary circle. She wondered how they were visible at night. As they approached Michigan Avenue, Sloane tilted her head back and looked for the black building that stood at the bend in Lakeshore Drive. But she couldn't find it. In its place was a wide glass tower with a hole in the middle. And hovering in the center of the hole, with space on all sides, was a sphere made of the same glass and metal as the rest of the building. How? She felt strange, like she wasn't standing in her own body anymore. How? "Oh, that. I'm not sure how it works," Kyros said, sounding amused. "Magic, obviously, but I'm unclear on the specifics." "It's not an illusion?" "No. Would you like to go in?" Sloane shook her head. No. She did not want to stand in a giant floating glass sphere. She put a hand to her aching temple. Across the street, she spotted something familiar. The Chicago Cultural Center, and walked straight toward it, not even glancing at the walk signal to make sure her path was clear. It was too much, too fast. She needed to sit, needed to breathe. Kyros chased her across the street and up the stone steps. The cultural center was old, which, she was realizing, meant that both universes would likely have it in common. A neoclassical building with a row of arches topped by a row of columns, like layers in a cake. But it was the inside that made it one of her favorite places. The domes of Tiffany glass that glowed colorful and beautiful in the morning sun. That and the space's persistent quiet. Just inside, she found a bench made of cool marble and sat, putting her head in her hands. Kiros sat beside her, not too close, thankfully, or she might have punched him, and stayed quiet as she took deep breaths through her nose. "It's a lot," she said once she felt calmer. Kiros nodded. "I'm sure it is." "Would you mind if I went up there?" She pointed up the stairs toward the Tiffany Dome. She could see only a sliver of it from where she sat, glinting green. But it promised familiarity and, if Kiros would allow it, solitude. "By myself, I just need a few minutes." Kiros narrowed an eye at her. "I promise I won't go anywhere else," she said. "All right," he said. "But in a few minutes, I'll come up to check on you." Sloane stood, feeling steadier now. She climbed the steps, then paused on one of the landings to look up at the Bacon quote. "The real use of all knowledge is this, that we should dedicate that reason which was given us by God for the use and advantage of man." Set in tiny tiles into the mosaic that covered each wall, framed on every side by green and yellow and blue patterns, spirals and diamonds, and draped ribbons. When she turned the corner, she saw the Tiffany Dome aglow in the sunlight. The walls arching up to meet it were covered in small tiles formed into organic shapes. Vines twisting and coiling together, bright green. The dome itself was simpler, divided into rectangular sections that shrank as they drew closer to the middle. Within each rectangle, the glass was arranged in small blue and green semicircles, like the scales of a fish. And in the center, the symbols of each astrological sign. A chandelier hung over the space, mirroring the shape and pattern of the dome itself. Across from her, three canvases were set up in front of the back wall. The two on either side were featureless from a distance, like Rothko's, massive and empty. The one in the center showed hints of light, like something cracking open to reveal something luminous inside it. She drew closer to see the label fixed to the wall near the paintings and found herself standing directly beneath the chandelier. And then, something caught her by the ankle, its fingers cold and strict, and jerked her foot up toward the ceiling. Sloane gasped as her body flipped upside down, thinking of the teenager who had floated into the clouds in the video Hendercho had showed them. And the walls began to turn around her. Or she was turning, guided by the hand around her ankle, the hand that didn't seem to be there at all. Her clothes floated away from her body but didn't fall down all the way. Her hair, too, was adrift around her, like she was in a pool of water instead of dangling in midair, staring at the floor as if it were a ceiling. Quiet, she found herself thinking. Her default thought when panic set in. Because quiet had helped her to escape the Dark One with Albie. Quiet had helped her escape death dozens of times. She clenched her jaw and went still, letting herself turn, dangling, like a Christmas ornament just placed on a branch. She thought if she could just jerk her leg free, but then she might fall headfirst onto a hard floor that had to be more than 6 feet below. She stared at her captive ankle as if the invisible force holding her might speak up and tell her what to do. "Hello?" a voice beneath her said. She flinched and looked up, or rather down. She was still turning, but the man's face was right beneath hers, separated by a few feet. She was higher than 6 feet above the ground then, because he appeared to be tall, so he was like the center of a pinwheel. "Do you need help?" he said. His voice was low but oddly musical for such a serious face. He was pale, with a nose that could politely be described as pronounced, and dark eyes that had not shifted from hers from the moment she first looked at him. The focus was unnerving. "What," she said, "the fuck is this?" He smiled a little. "An unrealist prank, I think," he said. "Here, take my hand and I'll get you out of the trap." The last thing Sloane wanted to do was hold hands with a strange man in a parallel dimension, but she didn't see that she had any other choice. She reached up, down, and they clasped hands firmly. He raised his other hand, which was encased in a black siphon that looked like a glove with no fingertips. It, like all of the siphons she had seen, was made of metal, but it had once been painted green. The paint was peeling at the edges, and there were large scuff marks and scratches across each plate. There were noticeable screws around its edges and visible hinges made of different colors of metal, suggesting that it had been repaired more than once. He hummed, a low rumble that she thought she might feel buzzing in her fingers. She felt the tension around her ankle break, like a cord snapping. He kept his hand outstretched and continued to hum, though he changed the pitch somewhat. Her leg slowly lowered, her body righting itself by degrees. Soon she stood in front of him, her hand still held in his for a moment before they both realized it was no longer necessary. Now that she was on the ground, she could see that he was a head taller than her, which was no small thing, given that she was tall herself. And he wore dark, muted colors, gray and navy and black, with that odd swath of fabric around his shoulders like a hood. It was pinned at his shoulder, not by the gold finery of Aelia and her peers, but by what looked like a large bolt. She smiled faintly at it. It almost seemed like a joke, to mock the same people who had summoned her to Genetrix. "Thanks," she said. "You said that was a prank?" "Yeah. The Unrealist Artists Collective have been setting up traps all over the city for a couple months now. Snares, they call them. I read their manifesto the other day. Someone wallpapered a train with them." She was about to ask what unrealists were, but then she remembered she was supposed to be blending in as much as possible and swallowed the question. "What did it say?" she said instead. It seemed like a safe thing to ask. "They contend that the introduction of magic unmoored us from the practical and therefore from reality itself," he said, "and question whether there's such a thing as a fact, when half the things we use to regard as facts are being upended. Hence the reversal of gravity that you just experienced." They had a point, she thought. Gravity was a law, and magic upended it, unraveled it. What else did magic unravel? Time? Space? Whole dimensions, maybe. "Well," she said, "interesting or not, I hate them." He laughed. His entire face crumpled when he laughed, and his mouth opened to reveal a row of slightly crooked teeth. "They're a nuisance," he said, "but a harmless one most of the time." His eyes shifted down to her hands. "No siphon of your own. A bold choice." "It's being repaired," she lied as smoothly as possible. She was the worst of all of the chosen at lying. Even Albie had been more convincing than she was. But she had practiced enough now that she wasn't completely hopeless. "It's a piece of shit," she added for authenticity. "Sounds like mine," he said, wiggling his fingers. "I know someone who does cheap repairs, though." A silence fell between them. Sloane knew she should stop the conversation there, thank him again, and go back downstairs to meet Kyros. But it had been a long time since she had spoken to someone who didn't know who she was or what she was. A lifetime, in fact. So she wasn't so eager to give it up. "So, you like the paintings?" he said, gesturing to the three canvases. She stepped closer to read the placard on the wall. "Tenebris, Charlotte Lake, 2001. I heard the artist speak last night, he said. She said people assume they're a view from the USS Tenebris before the incident, but they're actually from the perspective of magic, looking through the veil at the lights of the Tenebris. Sloane didn't know what to say. She didn't know what the USS Tenebris was, aside from a naval ship, obviously, or what the incident was, though it sounded familiar. I don't know how to look at art, she said. There hasn't been much room in my life for it. What's been taking up all the room? She considered that for a moment, then replied with a hint of a smile. Mayhem. He laughed a little, but his eyes lingered on hers, like he knew she wasn't quite kidding. I'm Mox, he said, holding out his siphon hand for her to shake. Sloane, she replied, wrapping her fingers around the metal. It was cool to the touch. So, you're into art, then? Not particularly, he said. I repair and customize non-Abraxas siphons, so I'm just here to deliver a finished product to a friend. Ah, she said. So the cheap repair guy you know is you. Lucky me, he said. Well, maybe I'll look you up if my repair guy does a shit job, she said. For the first time in a long time, Sloane was standing in her own skin. She was not a chosen one, or Bert's stray dog, or Sloane Andrews, the turbo bitch who some Trilby reporter wanted to hate fuck. And the second she had a little bit of herself back, she was desperate to get the rest. I better go, she said. She didn't want Kiros to come upstairs and spoil the moment. Well, if you want something to do later, he said, I sometimes pick up shifts at a bar in Printer's Row. The Tankard. The Tankard, huh? She said. I'll see if I can escape. She smiled. He smiled. And she started toward the staircase. But on the first landing, she couldn't help but look back. He was standing right where she had left him, staring intently up at the Tiffany Dome, his face rendered even paler by its light.
Top secret. Cordis, Memorandum 4, Controller. Attention, Finance Division. Subject, Project Delphi. Subproject 17. Under the authority granted in the memorandum dated 9 March 2004 from the Director of Central Intelligence to the Department of Magical Oversight on the subject of Project Delphi, Subproject 17, codename Flickering, has been approved. And $1 million of the overall Project Delphi funds have been allocated to cover the subproject's expenses. Flickering is here defined as a small military force intended to serve and protect the valuable entity known as Mage until such a time as his purpose dictated by the predictions of codename Sybil is fulfilled. Fatima Harak, Director of Security, Department of Magical Oversight.
Chapter 21. The Tenebris Incident? Kiros frowned and held the door for her as they exited the cultural center. No one's told you about the Tenebris incident yet? Should they have? Well, it's the foundational event of the modern world, Kiros said. So, let's see. It happened in 1969. The USS Tenebris was a naval ship that set out to test the response of a ballistic missile to the intense pressures of Challenger Deep. Sloane waited for the walk signal to flip. The deepest part of the ocean, right? The deepest part of the Mariana Trench, which is itself the deepest part of the ocean, Kiros said. They wanted to demonstrate naval strength after World War II. Due to a minor equipment malfunction, the Tenebris's deep water submersible had to touch down on a particularly precarious spot in Challenger Deep. The rocky expanse it settled on collapsed,
revealing an even deeper part of the deep later known as the Tenebris Gorge. No one is certain of what happened next, but the ballistic missile they had set out to test fired into the gorge, and the men in the Tenebris' submersible were buried alive in rubble. After that, magic spread throughout the world, sometimes with catastrophic results. The sidewalks were busier now, and louder. Whistles, hums, and sung vowels came from all directions in an array of pitches. Most of the workings, from what Sloane could see, were small and practical. A flash of light to hail a cab, a tiny flame to light a cigarette, a bubble of a shield to keep coffee from spilling. A group of teenagers sitting outside Jack's Magic Beans linked pinky fingers and hummed in unison, like they were performing a seance. Judging by the way they shed outerwear afterward, though, the working had been for warmth. "What kind of catastrophic results?" Sloane said, still craning her neck to look at the teenagers. One of the girls was using her siphon to shoot bubbles out of her fingertip at one of the boys. He whistled and poked one of the bubbles as if to pop it. Instead, it turned solid and gleamed like glass. But Kyros was talking again. "The earliest recorded incident was a sighting of the Leviathan, but it could have been a false report. Everyone is always spotting monsters. But then there was the Graves disturbance. Gravity failed over the gorge, and a massive fishing boat just floated away, along with a lot of water and, by some accounts, a baleen whale." "A whale?" "Evidently. Electrical storms caused power outages across large regions. All of England, actually. And one left the entire state of Florida without electricity for 2 weeks. Parts of the ocean boiled all the sea life alive. That was quite unpleasant to clean up after, though I'm told we discovered some interesting delicacies in that time, too. And then there was the plague that killed 1/8 of the world's population." The Camel was across the street, and from this angle, she could see the inner building with its hall of summons, poking out where the outer walls dipped low enough to reveal it. There was nothing cohesive in the design of it. It looked like dozens of ideas had been thrown in a blender and poured out while they were still chunky. "Kyros," Sloane said, "has anyone ever commented on the way you talk about catastrophe?" "No. Why?" "No reason." Ciliel was standing right in the middle of the lobby. Today she wore only blue. Blue lipstick, a blue feather stuck in her hair, tight blue trousers, and a billowing blue blouse with a high neck. She wore a hand siphon made of delicate gold chains that crisscrossed over her knuckles and wrapped in a dense cuff around her wrist. She didn't look pleased. "We've been looking for you," she said tersely. "I went for a walk," Sloane replied. "Kyros was kind enough to join me." "Nevertheless, you should clear it with someone before you. I wasn't aware I needed permission to leave this building." "The issue is not permission," Ciliel said. "If you don't care about my reaction or Nero's and Aelia's, then you might spare a thought for your friends who had no idea what happened to you." Sloane couldn't think of anything to say to that. "You're missing another training session," Ciliel said. "Come." Kyros nodded at Sloane, who reluctantly followed. Apparently she needed to learn a shield, at least. "A very hearty what the fuck to you," Esther said when Sloane walked into the room where they were training. The Hall of Summons, Ciriel had explained to Sloane as they walked, was closed for repairs after Sloane's stunt, Ciriel's word for what had happened the day before. Instead, they were in a bare room on the fourth floor of the Camel that was typically used as a meeting space for students. There were no windows, and the furniture, a few beat-up couches, was pushed against the walls, leaving a clear stretch of beat-up wood floors for their practice. Matt didn't even look in her direction when she walked in, just continued to hum into his oscilloscope. "Sorry," Sloane said, feeling somewhat helpless. "I just, whatever," Esther said, raising her siphon hand. "Just get to work." Sloane took the siphon Ciriel offered her, determined to do something useful with this session. She pulled the cord tight with her teeth and flexed her fingers.
Unfortunately, determination and intent didn't seem to be the same thing. Because the only thing she accomplished in the next 2 hours was reliably humming at 170 megahertz. Meanwhile, Esther had figured out how to modulate the strength of her magical breath. Matt had enough precision to fill a balloon with a succession of magical breaths, and Nero had cleared them both to move on to something else. Cyriel, who had been working one-on-one with Sloane, seemed ready to hurl the siphon, or Sloane herself, at a wall by the time she called the session to a close. After, Sloane went back to her room and flopped on her bed, her head throbbing. It was impossible to stop thinking so much, as Cyriel had instructed her to do. When you were thinking about not ripping your friends to shreds with magic, while simultaneously worrying that the resurrectionist would suffocate you if you didn't learn faster. There was a knock on her door, and then Esther was leaning on the doorframe, her arms crossed. She had adopted the thick eyeliner that people on Genetrix seemed to favor. Esther was nothing if not adaptable. "All right, so," Esther said, "you're a selfish dick, and apparently you've killed people." Sloane stared. She wasn't sure what to say to that. "I just figured it would be better to get it all out in the open," Esther went on. "While you were on your little stroll this morning and everyone else was fretting about where you were, I accepted your certain demise and went down to the library and looked up some names." "You accepted my demise pretty quickly." "I was pissed at you," Esther said, picking at a cuticle. "Anyway, first I got the librarian to search for our names, just to make sure there weren't parallel versions of us running around out there. Thank God she didn't find anything, or I'd probably lose every last marble I had left." Sloane had been so busy processing the other aspects of occupying a parallel universe that she hadn't spared a thought for Alterna Sloane, or her parallel parents. Parallel parents, she thought, and it was a joke she might have made to Albie, who was remarkably patient with wordplay. But Albie was dead. Sloane sat up and pushed the thought firmly aside. "I think the universes may have diverged in 1969, which means our parents would be alive here." "I tried that next, obviously," Esther said. "Did you know the internet here is basically a glorified card catalog? Susan, the librarian, described it to me. Anyway, it would take a huge effort to figure out if my or Matt's parents are alive and well, since they're in different states." "What about my mom?" Esther shrugged. "I kind of figured that was your business, whether you wanted to know about her or not. But I looked up Bert." Sloane hesitated between hope and scorn. Reading the letters Bert had sent to his superior about her had curdled her fondness for him like sour milk. But he had been a better parent to her than the one she was born with. And his death, just a few months shy of the Dark One's defeat, had been devastating. "Parallel Bert lives in Chicago, Hyde Park. I remember our Bert saying he had an aunt there. Seems like he lives in her old house, if the public records are accurate." Sloane got to her feet. She hadn't bothered to take her boots off before falling into bed. "So are we going to see him or what?" Esther walked over to Sloane's bedside table and picked up the book she had started reading, The Manifestation of Impossible Wants. The cover was plain white with a sketch of a wrist siphon on it in black. She flipped through it, too quickly to see any of the pages. "Matt thinks that's a dumb idea." "Matt doesn't have to come," Sloane said, shrugging. "Don't you want to know what he's like?" "Yeah, but..." Esther bit her lip. "I don't know. He's got nothing to do with our Bert except that he has the same combination of genes. That's not nothing." Esther put the book down. "We would have to be really clear on the fact that he's a different person from the one we knew. No expectations. Do you think that's even possible?" "Sure it is," Sloane said, even though she wasn't sure at all. "Essie, if parallel selves are similar, that means the resurrectionist could very well be a parallel version of the Dark One, which means we already know more about him than anyone else does. So this is an important test case. more information is always better. The older I get, the less I believe that. But we're going, right? Esther sighed. Yeah, we're going.
Top secret. Cordis, Project Delphi, Subproject 17. Subject: transcript of debriefing session with Cordis Council Member. Codename Merlin. Witness to destructive incident.
Can I get anything for you, sir? More water?
No, no thank you. This is plenty.
Can you state your name for the record? Sir, your name.
Oh yes, my name is... But for our purposes, I am known as Merlin.
Thank you.